Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the
City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
Yes, this is episode 108 of the podcast, 108. I am Dave, your host. Happy to have you listening yet again. Okay, today on the podcast, Shastri Ethan Nickturn is going to be talking about commitment. Commitment. This was a talk he gave a couple months ago, shortly after his wedding. So I suppose commitment was on his mind. But in this case, he was talking about committing to your path. What does it mean to take the next step in relationship to one's meditation practice, in relation to one's spiritual practice, and to commit? And what does that mean? What are the various ways that can mean? What are the various ways that can look like? Shastri Nickturn will be teaching, by the way, the evening of September 28th at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. He'll be teaching an evening called Learn to Work with Strong Emotions. That's September 28th. I believe that's a Wednesday evening, a one evening course. If you are interested in more than an evening, oh, my phone's ringing. Oh, look at that. Hey, there's my ringtone, everybody. Let's just get that turned off, shall we? If you are interested in more than just an evening, if you are interested in perhaps diving in to experience a weekend of meditation practice, September is a great time because we are offering, the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is offering Shambhala Training Level 1, the weekend of September 16th. That's September 16th, 17th, and 18th. Shambhala Training Level 1, Feel Human Again, with Acharya Eric Spiegel. For more information and to register for any or both of those courses, go to our website, ny.shambhala.org. And now, here is Shastri Ethan Nickturn talking about commitment.
Just because of some of the things going on in my life recently, I thought commitment to a path would be a good topic for tonight. You don't all have to get married. It's more we're going to talk about commitment to what a Buddhist path looks like. And I also want to acknowledge that you might not be interested in this. I think a lot of people in this room might just be in the realm of making use of or making friends with or struggling with, more likely, meditation practice, dealing with resistance to actually getting quiet with yourself and what that brings up. But it is interesting that in the book that Alec mentioned, this is one of the things I love about Kindle and ebooks. I don't know if you know this, but if you have a book on Kindle, you can see what the popular highlights are, which becomes about 100 times more interesting when you wrote the book, because then you can see what parts. It's sort of an opinion poll of, like, this is what caught people. And the most popular highlight Kindle passage in my book is where I defined what a Buddhist is. It's not where I was talking about meditation or mindfulness or emptiness or karma. It's here's what it means to be a Buddhist. So that's interesting. That seems to be something of interest. Even as we have this sort of period where mindfulness as a sort of practice, way of life, but also just as kind of a fad, has become so huge, people are really interested in where did this come from and what does it mean not just to meditate, but then the next step, I think, would be what does it mean to actually have a practice? Which can kind of actually sound, there's so many people, so many ways that people have practices. I often find when I'm talking about my practice, I have feelings of discomfort because it sounds kind of pretentious. like when people talk about their yoga practice or their art practice or writing practice or even law practice or meditation practice. Do you ever feel that, like when you're talking to somebody or somebody else is saying, my practice is blank, that it feels like a sort of pretentious mode of language? I don't know. Is that just me? I feel like a lot of that has to do with our relationship to what it means to commit to some kind of process, like to actually say, I get up in the morning and there's certain things I do each day, or I don't do them a few days and then I feel like something is missing, right? That's what it means to have a practice. You either do it regularly, or if you don't do it, it's like some piece of the way you arrange your life to be in the world is absent and needs to be re-engaged with. And then even deeper than that, there's this question of what does it mean to commit to a path? And that's really the point here where one would say, I am a Buddhist. And it's so interesting to actually claim some kind of identity in this world. It's interesting because, you know, on the one end of the spectrum, there's sort of people get really obsessed about their identity. You know, not even when we look at all the horrors going on in the world, but just like graphic designers can get really fundamentalist about Helvetica and can stop talking to people who prefer other fonts. You know, like, have you ever been in a conversation where you feel your own passion or someone else's passion turning into like, oh, this is really cutting you off from a larger world. This is really cutting me off from a larger world. And then obviously that's just a playful way of just thinking about, you know, when we think about committing to a path, how dangerous it can be if one takes on an identity or a path that gives you even stronger ways to obsess or to exclude other people or even commit violence. To walk into someone else's space and commit violence because they don't agree with your path or you don't agree with their path. It's like, so it's good. I think there's, you know, my life in the modern world is mostly dealing with, I deal with more people who are fundamentalist about fonts or Game of Thrones than people who are fundamentalist about their spiritual practice. But I think it is good to be wary of what it would mean to commit to a path in a way that you lose your access to other people's goodness or other people's perspectives. But then there's the other extreme, which is interesting, where you just don't have a path. I just, you know, I'm not really into that. I'm not really into identifying, which is such an interesting thing because you have a name, you have a family, we have a culture, we have a place we're from. So it's kind of interesting. I think about this in some ways, identity is what you choose, and in some ways it's like I'm an Ethan. It's already happening. I'm already a person. I don't need to worry so much about feeling fixed in an identity because it's part of life, right? To have a path. So, the thing that feels important to me, and I don't want to say this sounding fundamentalist, but the practice of meditation traditionally wasn't just meant to be something you did. It was meant to be a long period of time, a regular relationship to a process, which also means sometimes you forget the practice. And the practice of meditation, from a Buddhist standpoint, was never meant to be separated from the integrity of having a complete path. And there's a real wisdom to saying, I like this part, the mindfulness part. I'm not really into having a teacher. I'm not really a community person, so that whole thing about Sangha, not really for me. I get that, like, take what works and leave the rest. But imagine if you took what works and left the rest in, like, a painting. Like, imagine if you were allowed to say that. I really like the upper left corner of Van Gogh's paintings. That's a little bit, from a classic Buddhist perspective, what it's like to say, I'm really into mindfulness, but I'm not into Buddhism. It's meant to be part of a complete, you could say, a complete spiritual system, but I actually think a better way to look at it is, it's meant to be a complete system of immersive learning, right? And in my book, I do the simple thing of just actually fully translating the term Buddhist as awakest. And that tends to be an identity that people, it's easier to say, yeah, I'm trying to be wakeful in my life than to say I'm a Buddhist, right? But that's just literally what the word means. Very little work was done there. And then to say I'm a Shambhalian means that there was a place, supposedly a mythical place, where people tried to help each other wake up. And rather than saying, like, I'm a Shambhalian and other people are Kundalini yogis or other people are Theravadin Buddhists and I separate myself from them, it's just saying, like, I would like to be identified among the people who are trying to wake up, who have a complete immersive path to do that, and are also trying to help society, to view society as the coming together of awakened people. So it's interesting, whenever an identity is left untranslated, it has more power to separate and isolate than when you just say, what does that identity actually mean in terms of what you do every day? And then I feel like it becomes a lot more accessible. And there do seem to be a lot of disputes going on in the world where people just don't realize that they're talking about words that link to actions, like that the words actually mean something, you know, like that, I don't know, what's an example, like, you know, a lot of it just becomes preferences or what works for us, but we don't have to be so identified in a way that we feel like our identity is radically separate, you know. And I think it's also, if you are interested in the path of Shambhala Buddhism, like actively, it is very important for me as somebody who's, you know, kind of holding this banner, to hang out regularly with people who don't give a damn about Shambhala. Just so that I don't become one of those Helvetica-obsessed people, if you know what I mean. So I think that's also part of having a path, is to keep touching in with people who have different paths. Now, that being said, I'm going to use just a very classic framework to talk about six elements of a complete path. And you could just think of one of these. If you're thinking of, if you're just dabbling with meditation, that's one of the six. So you could just say, how do I commit to that process a little bit more? If you want to. But if you want to go deeper and have what was meant to be the whole Van Gogh painting, it actually includes all six of these. But it's very personal for each of us. There are some shared guidelines for sure, but it's really up to you. If you meet a fundamentalist Buddhist, they've kind of missed the point. And if I come across that way, I would rather come across as being too timid about saying, anything like you should, you guys should probably meditate more. Even though that's from the standpoint of our nervous systems and health and longevity in the world, probably true. But I would rather not even be timid about saying that than for somebody to be like, why was he preaching so much? Get that person down. The world has so many soap boxes. And it's much better if we find our own path with help from our friends, I think. I don't know. What do you think? If anyone wants the soapbox version, I can recommend some Buddhist teachers. Some people want that. Tell me what to do. Different personality types. Okay, so the first three of these six has to do with a complete understanding of the practices that a person takes on in the Buddhist tradition. They're sometimes called the three trainings. And in a sense, from this educational model, these are the sort of three activities that make the path complete, that make the path moving towards a day in, day out. What do I do on the cushion? What do I do off the cushion? And the first one is the practice of meditation, the practice of working with one's own mind and being willing to inhabit that uncomfortable space of, here I am, deal with it. That's the least sexy way I could possibly... Sure, you could talk about it as bliss and transcendence and moments where... Did anybody have a blissful moment while we were meditating together? Just happy... Yeah, that happens. It's the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. It's the beauty of having five senses. It's the amazing aspect of being a smart person in this world. It also doesn't happen. What always happens is I'm going to make friends with what my mind is doing right now and kind of realize that all escapes from that are temporary. Eventually, I have to come back to my own mind. And it'd be nice if that was a little bit each day, even if it's 5 minutes. Which sounds like a weak negotiation, even if it's 10 minutes. So that's the first of the three trainings. The second is the training in, the Sanskrit word is shila, and this is a word that's either translated as discipline or conduct or ethics. I actually like the translation conduct. This is really how we work with life off the cushion. In classic Buddhism, in the Shambhala teachings, there's different precepts. And they're never meant to be like commandments of action in the world. They're meant to be, think about this, contemplate this. So I was teaching with my dear friend and teacher, Sharon Salzberg, last week. And we talked about one of the principles of conduct that a Buddhist takes on is to contemplate the ways we intoxicate ourselves. And we could take that literally. But in the Shambhala tradition, we really look at the ways that intoxication means to be curious about the ways we escape the present moment or lose our awareness off the cushion. And I'm 100% convinced now, just my own practice and what everybody talks about, that in the... One of the main ways in 2,600 years ago that this was encountered was fermented beverages, alcohol, which it still is one of the main ways. But I think there is an even more prevalent intoxicant that steals so many people's minds so much of the time, and I think it's technology. And so you could just look at how am I mindful with my technology? Not to make a drastic change, but just what if you had a 5-minute practice of no technology? For some people, that's literally, like, if they really admitted, that would be harder than a 20-minute meditation session. Would be 5 minutes not meditating in the world without your phone. So conduct has a sense of things like that. It's other things like our destructive patterns, the way we might harm others, the way we might kill beings. For some people, this is a contemplation of vegetarianism. Tibetan Buddhism does not have a strong history of vegetarianism, for whatever reason. Some people criticize it for that. Shambhala, as a descendant of Tibetan teachings, doesn't really emphasize vegetarianism, although some of my friends in Shambhala make strong cases for why that should be changed. Right? But that could be a way to contemplate it. But so conduct is the second of the three trainings. And the third is study. It's really, there's a vast body of teachings on the mind in the Buddhist tradition. There's a vast body of teachings on the mind in the Western tradition. It's nice to be an adult person and still studying something that you choose to study. So that's what I would say is, if you're interested in Buddhist practice, read a little bit every day. You know, I was taking the L train on Sunday morning, 9 a.m., and somebody was reading Pema Chodron on the L train. That's a good time to study. It could also be a good time to practice loving kindness. But it's up to you what practice you do on the subway. But that is a space for practice in this second training, right? And in the third training, we really look at how we studying, you know. That's a good part of the Shambhala teachings, is how rich the actual philosophical teachings are and how sequentialized in the courses and weekends that we have here it is. You can, it's like a graduate course that never ends, which I know Scientology also has one of those, so I'm wary about that. But it's not meant to be framed that way. It's meant to be so that there's always a way to connect and contemplate more. It's not, we don't call it a ladder, thankfully, or a bridge. Just a path to being with yourself and others. So those are the three trainings. So just so I know that you got those, let's go back over the three trainings. What's the first? Meditation. Second, conduct or Shila or... Yes, and third? Study, okay. The third, and this is really when one takes a formal vow, which vows have a very interesting place in Buddhism and in life, and it's really interesting to be married, not just because, you know, I won the jackpot on who I married, but it's really interesting to be married because that is actually one of the few remaining places in Western life where there's this sense of like, oh, so we're going to actually formalize a practice together here, and we're going to invite people who are important to us to witness the practice, and we're not always going to do the practice, or I'm not always going to do the practice perfectly, but that's what makes it a practice. And so when one formally becomes a Buddhist, it's almost like you get married to your own path. And there's a ceremony called the Refuge Vow Ceremony, which we do here once a year. And in that, you kind of commit to these three supports for the path. So there's three trainings, which are the three arenas of practice. And then there's the three jewels, which are the three supports for your path. And to make them the most accessible to an educational model, the first one I'm going to translate as teacher. You could also translate as wisdom holder. Traditionally, it's called Buddha. I take refuge in the Buddha. Now, the most literal way of thinking about that is this guy who was apparently a spiritual hero 2,600 years ago. But really, in modern life, it means that I'm going to include in my path a connection with teacher or teachers. And I think this is one of the problems, I would say, to be honest, with how popular meditation has got just in the last 5 years, is that we lack the infrastructure for everybody to have a personal relationship with teacher or teachers, although it is growing. It's hard to find available teachers. It's hard to find teachers we connect with. But it's a helpful support, and it's a helpful contemplation. And there's lots of different ways that that principle can be present. And then the other way of thinking about this support is the inner teacher, that we all have the inner Buddha, who, when we really settle, we can actually start to touch in with our own wisdom. And it's really when we really connect with the path fully, my experience is it becomes harder to deceive yourself. And a good teacher, they're very supportive. I think the best teacher is, to steal a phrase from Western humanist psychologist Carl Rogers, the best teachers demonstrate a quality of unconditional positive regard. I don't know if you've heard that phrase. Just reflecting back, this is one of the things my mother, who was a student of Chogyam Trungpa, said about Chogyam Trungpa, the founder of our lineage, and I trust her because she doesn't usually, if she doesn't like somebody, she'll be clear. And she said, he really never thought there was anything fundamentally wrong with anybody. So a good teacher, I think, will have some of that quality. And then on that basis, when they tell us, like, work on this, we trust them because they think we're fundamentally good. And that's a really interesting thing, that we often trust wisdom when trust has been built that the person really thinks there's something wise in us. And so the teacher becomes a reflection of that inner quality. But as whatever relationship we have with a teacher or teachers, as the relationship progresses, if it's progressing properly, it gives us more access to the inner teacher, the inner Buddha, the inner you're great, you're basically good, and I'm not going to let you get away with this self-deception. Does that make sense? The second is related to the practice of study, and the second of the three refuges or three jewels is Dharma, that you actually have a path of some body of teachings that you're working with. And, you know, I work with a lot of people who dabble with different teachings. It's the way I was educated. You could, my college had no required courses. Time went by very quickly there because of that. But, like, that you're actually, it's nice to say at a certain point, I'm doing this body of teachings. Just because it's coherent. It has its own, every body of teachings has its own integrity and its own kind of narrative arc. And it's nice to experiment, and then it's nice to say, let's go deep. And I really like what a Zen teacher named Roshi Bernie Glassman, who's actually the teacher of the Big Lebowski. So that's literally, he's Jeff Bridges' Dharma teacher, and they wrote a book together. Does a lot of great work with bearing witness and social justice. And Roshi Bernie Glassman says, there are many places you could dig a hole to build a well to get to fresh spring water underneath. There are many different places that lead to fresh spring water, but if you don't dig one hole deep enough, you'll never get there. And I do find, in my experience, because I get to talk to a lot of people who are on the path, sort of on the path, on their path. I see them on the subway platform. I run into them in another city. And I do find that the ones who say, not that I'm a fanatic, but I'm working with this teacher or this lineage on this path, there's a more grounded quality. But again, that's something that comes when you feel like, okay, I'm ready to commit, right? You don't just pair off and get married. You don't just say, okay, I'm at the Shambhala Center, let me go to Vajrayana Seminary and eventually take on Sakyong Nipam Rinpoche as my guru. You build to that. But I do think having a core body of teachings, and you're talking to somebody who likes to study a lot of different teachings, but the Shambhala teachings are my core body of teachings. There's something very grounding and stabilizing about that. So that's the Dharma, that you're working with a core body of teachings in a deep way as your foundation. And then the last one is Sangha. Almost everybody I know who gives up on meditation practice, it's because they don't have support of other friends who are practicing. They don't have a culture, or what one friend likes to call an ecosystem around them, of people who are supporting them. No. I'm just wondering here, how many people are at the Shambhala Center and because you're here with a friend, or a friend said you should go here? How many people would link that to? And how many people come back here because you've made friends here? So it's, you know, we live in the most claustrophobically isolating city in some ways. But I do love that there is a sense of community. And when you find friends who do what you do, or do their version of what you do, and you take refuge in that, you make the cultivation of those peer relationships part of your practice. It really deepens the whole thing, because you're creating a sort of supportive, interwoven momentum. You know, friends can really bring out the best in us, or they can bring out the worst in us. And it's nice to have experience with both. I definitely recommend everybody, without causing major harm, dabble with a few self-destructive friendships. Give yourself some poems to write or some songs to write. Honor that. And then at a certain point, your close relationships, you want to be people who remind you that life is short, that being present is better than frenetic escapism, and that compassion is a good quality to build. It actually helps you enjoy life more, and it makes the world better. So the three jewels, the three educational supports, are Buddha, or teacher, Dharma, Sangha, community, friends on the path. All right.
I've been thinking for a while in terms of like applying a rubric to other traditions outside of Buddhism, because it just seems like a good idea when you're talking with other people. And I'm wondering specifically about meditation, how that might apply to traditions where they might even say, oh, I don't meditate, but they might be doing something else entirely.
Yeah. So there's so many different definitions of meditation. That's part of the problem. A literary review will often call a book a meditation on blank, right? Which really means contemplative meditation, or some kind of shared contemplation on something, which contemplative meditation is one of the styles of Buddhist meditation. You know, I think the key parts of Buddhist meditation to be in conversation with other people about are this sense of some kind of technique or framework for getting to know the mind. It's not necessarily a practice of transcendence, the idea that you're going to get past yourself in some way. And lots of traditions have periods of silence where the practitioner is becoming more familiar with something, whether it's prayer or an aspiration. So it's interesting to think about what is the relationship between, say, a loving kindness meditation and a prayer for the well-being of a certain group of people, right? Yeah. It might be that what the Buddhist tradition includes, which is why I think Western psychology has been so alertly in conversation with it, is not just a sense of like, this is the spiritually advantageous thing to do, but it's also like, here's why it works psychologically. So my conversations about Buddhism, I always go more in that direction because Buddhism feels like it's more mechanistically, scientifically interested in like what the mind is doing when it prays. Yeah. But I think it's nice to have that conversation, and especially if somebody, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are going to benefit from mindfulness meditation, who are, you know, the country is still 70-something% Christian.
Right.
So, and if we can't establish that conversation, for example, because I work with friends and students who are trying to establish mindfulness organizations and have established mindfulness organizations to teach mindfulness in public schools. So if we can't figure out some communication, there might be a chance, and I saw this as a potential dark side, that mindfulness spreads like wildfire in private schools and gets banned from public schools, which would just be another meditation privilege kind of thing, but it would be over the sort of freedom of religion thing. So it's nice to engage in that conversation. Like, it's always nice to ask somebody what their practice is and how they feel, like what the practice does for them. Sometimes people don't want to share, but I think that's the best way to have those conversations. And then somebody might say, and this is the way I have to stay open, is somebody might say, you know, ecstatic dance is the way I get there, or painting is the way I get there. And I could, like, quote Buddhist teachers who say why that's a great augmentation of meditation practice, but it's not meditation practice itself. But I actually have to listen to the person having the experience, and then talk about what I'm doing, you know. And honestly, like, the When Harry Met Sally approach is the way that these teachings are actually going to affect people. You know what I mean? Why the...
I'm not sure.
I'll have what she's having?
Yeah.
You know, that's actually what makes somebody want to do something. It's like you see a person and like, oh, you seem to deal with your stuff just slightly differently. What do you do? And that creates the interest, you know. I think a lot of times how fundamentalism works is there's this like sort of feeling of like, I have something that helps me and it does help me. And therefore, I see another person in pain or suffering, and I need to convince them to get on board right now, or else everybody's screwed. And sometimes it's good to just like be like, yeah, if you know, 30 years from now, or 30 lifetimes from now, you know, that's my hope for one of our presidential candidates. I think he might be on the 30 lifetimes from now. Has to work through some classical Freudian grandiosity first. Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious what your thoughts are on the idea of self-discipline when it comes to meditation. For me, I have days where I'm like really stoked to get on the cushion, and then there are days where I really don't want to do it. And half the time I would say I give in and decide not to, and then
you give in and don't do it.
I give in to my laziness, and then there are times where I decide to, you know, push past it.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a question of maybe aligning intention and practice.
But. Yeah. This is self-discipline is an interesting one. That's part of where Sangha comes in. I think that's if it's so much easier to remember do something if your friend invites you to do it. That's part of it. Another part of it is a lot of times discipline and conduct in classical Buddhism is framed in terms of what you don't do. In other words, what you refrain from. So you don't watch Netflix in modern terms, or you don't get drunk before you practice, or whatever it is. But I think we are so negatively oriented when you look at the typical modern human that you have to think about it in terms of what am I doing? So, because we're always doing something. So if it's just like I have to stop doing that, like if you're trying to quit a habit, I think it's incredibly hard to quit any habit without giving yourself some positive replacement habit to actually make friends with, to familiarize yourself with, to immerse the mind in for a moment. Because we're always doing something, and if it's just about refraining, it's really hard. The other thing is, I think you have to be curious about your own mind. I imagine those days that you're stoked, it's because there's something has shifted, or you read something, or heard something, or had an experience where you're like, what is my mind going to do next? And wouldn't it be amazing to like see that, witness that, work with that? And, you know, that can feel sort of self-cherishing or selfish to be like, I'm taking an interest in my own mind. But I think there has to be some kind of you could view it as like, my mind is a movie theater. Let me watch that movie for a little while, you know? And, because it really is like that. And if you're not curious about your own mind, it's going to be like, it's going to feel like doing taxes. You know, coming back is going to feel like the IRS is telling you to come back, and you don't even really know what you're supposed to do. And there has to be a curiosity. So I imagine those days that you're stoked, you find that curiosity, and half the days is good. I think as it builds, it might just become a little bit more, this is who I am and this is what I do, but there's always going to have to be that curiosity. Even if it's a curiosity to revisit a place you've already experienced, you have to look forward to it rather than like, this is paying my spiritual taxes. Because it's just going to be on the to-do list, and even if you do it, there's going to be all kinds of subtle resentments that aren't really going to be that helpful. So, is that helpful?
Hi.
What
would be your piece of advice for someone who's perhaps struggling between two different paths, especially if one path is, you know, one they were born into? Would you recommend them working within that path before they moved on to the next one?
I miss the one, especially if that one path is what...
That they're born into.
One that they're born into. And the other path is one that you're interested in?
Yes.
And are you interested in the path that you were born into?
Yeah, I think there's a curiosity, but I wonder how long you are curious about it before you choose the next.
I think the moment that you actually choose is when you realize you've been running over the same ground and the same doubts without making progress, like that the curiosity has become sort of just a loop, a way to not deepen with something. But the way I think about it, the way I've thought about my own path, and this might be a helpful visual image, is it's kind of an hourglass shape. And if you have multiple paths, and, you know, assuming that the path you were born into is not just, it doesn't just feel like sort of, paying homage to your family or something like that, which, you know, describes a lot of my teenage years. Assuming that there is some curiosity about multiple paths, I think there's a period where the hourglass is very wide at the base, and you're checking different things out, and you are building your own relationship to your practice. And then there might be a moment, which might take a year, might take 5 years, might take 5 minutes, I don't know, but there might be a moment where you say, I'm sort of going around in circles at the base, and I want to commit. And there is in commitment, there's a narrowing down. Right, that's the sort of trade-off of committing, is you're not going to go to 7 different yoga centers anymore. You're going to go to 1 yoga center, you know? You're going to do, for example, here, you would say, like, oh, there's all these other teachers in town. Oh, I have to spend, 5 weekends in the coming year going to the Shambhala Center. So that would be a kind of narrowing down, and that's the narrow part of the hourglass. But then I think there is a kind of opening back up. You know, and I started a nonprofit organization from this phase of sort of my own process with it, was opening back up and sort of saying, what is a conversation among many different traditions look like? But I think it's very personal. I think you commit when you feel, when your inner Buddha says, you're running in circles on this one, and you're going against something you know to be true, you know. But I'm not sure that the born into it has anything to do with it for me. I mean, it's just you have to be interested in it for that even to be a contender. Otherwise, it's just really honoring where your family is coming from, you know. And that's something, both my parents being in this tradition, I had to really think about, did I really like this? And at a certain point I was like, I kind of love it, and it's parts of it are kind of ridiculous and stupid. And but yeah, it's mine. It's mine. There's nothing better, you know. And I can work with being myself within this commitment, you know. And I think that for me is the sweet spot. But it takes a while to get there, especially if you feel any kind of lineage pressure or family pressure. So maybe that's a good moment to stop. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Shastri Nickturn. And thanks for listening. Hey, you listened to the whole thing. Way to commit. Way to do it. That was fun, yeah? If you'd like to explore some more commitment, even just a little bit, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. Our fall semester is starting in September. We have lots of great new courses and weekend programs coming up. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Tell your friends about the podcast. You can email us, of course, at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. I am now going to commit to eating my lunch. Later.